The tales are depraved and spooky. The drinks they sip are boozy. Tune in and you'll hear a doozy. The Tipsy and Depraved.
Hey everybody, this is Tipsy and Depraved, a morbid history podcast where we explore some of the darkest stories humanity has to offer. Each episode, we will have a master of depravity who will select a specific topic or theme. Then each of us will tell a different story that matches. To make it even more fun, we choose a cocktail to go along with the episode that you can make at home and sip along. Tonight, we're drinking dirty Shirley Temples. So, Sprite,
she dirty,
vodka, grenadine, and some lime juice. She dirty. And we're covering some missing persons. And since missing persons are usually some small children, I thought Shirley Temples went really well with this theme. It's kind of messed up, but
it's more, hey, fits the theme of the podcast.
It is what it is.
The name of the podcast is Tipsy Depraved. You're fine.
Yeah, it is what it is.
This drink is one of those drinks that just gets you, like, right from the start.
It's so delightful.
Because it's yummy. You don't even know. I love how Chelsea's drinking hers out of a mug, and I'm drinking mine out of a water bottle.
Look what it says.
Life is relentless.
Life is fucking relentless.
It's a crab cookie with cigarette.
Using, like, a glass.
Yeah,
I'm drinking out of my water bottle. Yeah, you're proper Shirley Temple drinker right now.
Yeah, I have a mug with a crab smoking a cigarette that says life is relentless.
Chelsea looks like she's doing the morning show. We haven't even started.
God, we haven't gotten past the intro.
Let's do this. This is the story of Jan Broberg. She was kidnapped twice by the same family friend.
Wait.
When she was 12.
Wait.
Don't spoil it.
There's a documentary about this, isn't there?
There is a documentary on Netflix.
I've seen it.
Abducted in Plain Sight.
Yep. Oh, okay.
It's here we most go. Frustrating documentary I have ever seen. I have never wanted to yell at a television screen more. And yeah, it just gets worse over time. Like, you think you're watching a normal kidnapping story, and then it takes a sudden turn in the middle of that documentary that you're like, what the actual fuck?
I feel like anytime there's a kidnapping story, there's a sudden dark turn that happens when they're kidnapped.
Well, spoiler alert, she didn't die. She's alive. She's an actress. And she wrote a book. I forget what show she's in. You gotta look up her IMDb. She's got a lot. Like, she's usually that person that you know from that show kind of thing.
Mm.
So.
Very descriptive.
I know. I'm really good at this. So, I think it's really upsetting because when Jan was kidnapped, her parents, like, couldn't even believe that Berchtold, which is the man, Robert Berchtold, is her abductor, didn't mean her any harm. So let's preface this story. Bob Broberg was a florist and his wife was a stay-at-home mom. Her name's Marianne. These are Jan's parents. They met Robert Berchtold and his family at church. Their families were around the same age. Robert was a very charismatic man and Bob and Robert became friends. They even have the same name.
Mm-hmm.
The wives also became really close. Robert's wife is described as just super quiet, but they all became friends and everybody was super close. They went on family vacations together, you know, neighborly things that they would do with each other. Berchtold would even pick up the kids for school in the morning, and like he eventually got a nickname B. So from here on out, Robert Berchtold will either be referred to as B or Berchtold. Berchtold became B. So
B.
He started to come over because he was their family friend. So he would come over most nights and talk to the parents and hang out with the kids. There's some creepy ass pictures if you look online of him just like hugging their three children, and like he's got major creeper vibes. Don't let
grown men hug your children.
Yeah, I don't know.
Like, if they're not related, like, why do they need to be hugging your kids? That's weird.
Yeah. Well, I think we're going to be extra creeped out by this story because there's so much internet stories. Like, we're raised on true crime. Obviously, this is, like, our podcast. This is the 70s.
Mm, yeah.
The story is taking place in the 70s. We don't have any of this. People trust their neighbors. Right. Like, if you're friends with somebody,
Stranger danger wasn't a thing.
Not yet.
Stranger danger was not a thing, nor like nobody knows about grooming or pedophilia. Like, it's not a thing. It's not mainstream, let me say. It may have been a thing, but it wasn't like mainstream talked about. It's not part of pop culture.
Right.
So it gets super creepy because Jan like starts referring to B as like her second father.
I don't like that. I don't like that at all.
Yeah. So the first time Jan is abducted, she's supposed to go out horseback riding with B. And apparently this is like a normal thing. If I have three children and I'm only letting one kid go with the father, where's his kids? Why aren't they coming?
Right. But why are they alone?
I digress. Yeah. Mother gives permission for her to go horseback riding with B after her piano lessons.
Great. No.
They get in the car. B gives her an allergy pill before they headed to the stables because, you know, they're going to see horses. And she thought, that's like, I have allergies. Sure.
There might be pollen in the air.
You could be allergic to horses.
Let me take this Benadryl really quick.
So really, Jan had, so she's drugged and taken to the Mexican desert. The worst part about this is that the parents waited 5 days before calling the police.
5 days?
Yeah. My kid doesn't show up at night.
Where are social services?
They didn't want to upset Gail, Robert's wife, B's wife.
Why didn't she call? Her husband's missing. She waited five days.
She did not call.
She wanted him to be gone.
Parents debated. Wait, it gets worse. Parents debated, like day two, they debated whether or not they should call. They almost called and then they didn't. And they waited another couple of days because they really did not believe that he had kidnapped her. They didn't believe that. The mom literally says that they've just gone someplace.
I'm sorry, but if
we should turn that into a drinking game.
You put the feelings if you put the feelings of your child's abductor's wife ahead of your child's own safety, you should not be a parent.
No, and they also just truly didn't believe that he had done anything.
Yeah, but even if you don't believe that, he didn't do it, it's still your child and his and missing your person. Best friend are missing. Yeah. So, like, where was... I get not wanting to believe that he took her, but then what the fuck did you think happened if they're both gone?
They told the police that they don't think he's kidnapped her.
That doesn't mean
nothing. I'm sorry, but if the shoe fits, he took her.
The police had to convince them, repeatedly telling them, no, she's been kidnapped. She's your daughter. She is with a man that is not you. Yeah. Yep. Oh yep.
The simple minds of the 70s. Like,
it's great. I love the detective in this story because he's just like, no, y'all are stupid. So Jan wakes up in Birchtold's motorhome because we have motorhomes in this time. Mm-hmm. And tape recordings were telling her that aliens were now in charge and that she would meet a man and have a child with him in order to save the planet. Jan says she believed everything she heard. She's 12.
Oh. Yeah.
She's 12. Remember, we just talked about Slenderman here. So She's 12. Meh. It is what it is.
It shouldn't be what it is.
Well, like, the aliens also said, so the man is obviously, like, the man that she has to procreate with to save the world is Birchtold. So we all know how that train ends.
Mm.
Yeah.
Arf.
I don't even need to say it. So during the FBI investigation, there was evidence that arose that Birchtold had a history of being a pedophile.
You think?
His own brother says that he molested his stepsister. So I guess they're stepbrothers. So the sister isn't technically blood related to her. Or I don't know how the blood works, but the sister wasn't technically related to him. Not that that matters, because she's like six and he was 12 at the time molesting a six-year-old. So dude has a history of being disgusting. After 5 weeks, the FBI tracked Jan and Birchtold down, and Birchtold only served a few days in jail for kidnapping Jan. A few days.
Sorry. There are people who are in jail for life for nonviolent crimes that really didn't put anyone in danger. They're in jail for life. And people who abduct and, like, sexually abuse children, murder people, get 25 to life, but sometimes they're out in 5 years for good behavior. It doesn't make sense.
It's great. So, okay. So 1974 is when she was abducted. They meet Birchtold in 1972. And there's a lot of effed up shit that goes on leading up to this. And I've bullet pointed them for your convenience.
Oh, thank you.
Birchtold, some fun stories, because we only got, like, you know, 20 minutes to tell our stories. Birchtold built a wall in the room that Jan shared with her sister to give them privacy because she was getting older, as he put it. Wouldn't you want some privacy? So man literally builds a wall in the girl's basement apartment. Like, bedroom, I mean. Jan recalls that they would all do sleepovers at the Birchtold house all the time, where Birchtold would definitely abuse Jan and then tell her it was just bad dreams. Yeah. Jan would frequently go by herself on trips with the Birchtold family.
Why?
Mm-hmm. And he would tell, like, when he would get back and they would have dinners, he would tell the family weird stories about her not feeling well and how he would have to take her back to the room by themselves.
Oh, no.
And the parents, this is the best one. The parents let him sleep in the same bed as their 12-year-old daughter.
What the actual fuck?
Because he told the parents it was part of his therapy to be alone with their daughter. And apparently 4 times a week for 6 months this happened.
There's a point when the parents' naivety becomes, like, impossible to believe. It's impossible to believe the parents were that naive.
I think I can't understand how, like, if you look at him, you can tell he's a pedophile. He looks like every other pedophile picture we have ever seen. And I can't not look at him with, you have to see, Jackie, look up the picture of him hugging the three girls that are not his. You would think those are his children. And the look on his face is pure, like, gross. Like, I feel uncomfortable looking at that picture.
Mm-hmm.
So, the best part of this also, and I would say, man is a master manipulator. And it's a little scary how manipulative he is. So, in the months before the kidnapping, he persuaded both the mother and the father to have sex with him.
Yeah. And they still didn't think he was having sex with their kid?
Well, no, because they were both having sex with him, apparently. So basically, when she's kidnapped, he has leverage to blackmail both of them into signing affidavits that show he had consent to take Jan to Mexico in the first place. So basically, man seduced an entire family to get to their kid.
That's fucking crazy.
Yep. So they let him go. He moves to Utah to work at his brother's car dealership. He came home every weekend, and the family was still so nice to him. They even mention it in the documentary that they were all so nice to him. The church was so welcoming. Everybody was freaking nice. Jan and B wrote letters to each other and kept in contact, and she thought she was in love. She's like 13 at this point.
And does she still think that she needs to have his baby to save humanity?
Yes. She's paranoid. She thinks that, like, if they don't fulfill this, like, to save humanity, like, the world's going to end. Her family's going to die. Like, she's super paranoid after this.
Oh, baby.
So at the time she's writing these love letters between her and B, the mom is also sleeping with him for almost a year. And the husband was told by B after their first, like, sexual encounter, like, B called the husband and said, yo, I just slept with your wife. And then still continued to fuck his wife for like 8 months while also seeing Jan quite often, spending two nights absolutely alone in this time.
No. How do you let a man who abducted your child for, what, 5 days to Mexico?
Not 5 days. Like, 5 weeks.
Oh, okay, 5 weeks.
Hey, remember, and it took him 5 days to call the cops. And,
oh, that's right. And you still let, like, they come back, and then you still let them have alone time together.
And yep. You sleep with them.
No, you're sleeping with him. You are in love with him.
I'm sorry, but, like, I don't like these people. They're idiots.
Yep. There was something unfinished about the whole first court case where he's kidnapping her. And in 1976, B is finally sentenced. So kidnapping happened in 1974. In 1976, B was sentenced finally to 45 days in prison. And he was reported to jail in 3 months from that sentencing. There was some drama between Jan and her family because she is completely fucking brainwashed at this point.
45 days is pretty much the same amount of time that she was kidnapped.
Mm-hmm. Pretty much. Yep. So there's some drama. Jan fights with her parents and Jan runs away, in quotations. The night that Jan runs away, the next morning, B calls the parents saying that Jan called him, telling him that she ran away and that he was worried. They waited 2 weeks before they called the FBI.
Parents of the year.
2 weeks. 2 weeks. Your daughter has been kidnapped once already. You waited 5 days the first time. She runs away. And you wait 2 weeks to call the FBI? What? So the FBI, like the smart-ass people they are, called Berchtold, and he pretended like he's all worried. And he only ends up spending 10 days in jail out of that 45-day sentence. And then he moves to Salt Lake City after that 10 days in jail and then disappears. That coincidence?
No, don't think so.
Definitely not.
So the FBI installs recording devices in the Broberg home because B keeps calling for months after Jan runs away. And 90 days after her second abduction, they found Berchtold in his motorhome, and the FBI surveils his motorhome for weeks. They finally get a lead and they follow him to a phone booth. And when they went into it, he had left the phone book open. And they traced the phone number that was written there to a Catholic all-girls school. So turns out he had tricked the nuns working there that he was a CIA agent, that Broberg was an escapee from Lebanon during the Lebanon crisis, and had to enroll his daughter.
Oh my God.
Into school. So he enrolls her under a fake name, and when the FBI figured it out, they arrested Berchtold, and he was ordered into a mental facility and was released 6 months later.
Crazy.
And that is the extent of his time in prison.
I would like to hear this guy, like, speak just to understand how, like, charismatic he is.
No, like, I don't. If you've seen the documentary on Netflix, which I highly recommend, you will. I left so much out. You will scream at your laptop or your TV because it is so frustrating the way these parents talk about how they were in love with Berchtold and about how he manipulated the father into feeling sorry for him for not having sex with his wife. So the father felt like he had to please Berchtold and relieve him. And that's how he manipulated the father into giving him a handjob. Like, it is insanity when you hear them talk about him. Insanity. God. And it's so frustrating.
I don't understand.
Berchtold, like, and I don't even understand, like, how he doesn't serve time. Like, yeah. They just are so delusional about him and everything. And he just never serves time. The mom and Jan eventually write a book. And Berchtold, and this is, like, in the 90s, and Berchtold, like, starts, like, retaliating and saying it wasn't true and that they made up the whole shit about the aliens. And they end up in court in, like, 2003, 2004, early 2000s. And, like, this is, like, 30 years after.
That's crazy.
And after that encounter, shortly after, he, like, commits suicide. Mm-mm-mm. And that is the most frustrating kidnapping story I have ever read. Wild. And or watched.
That's wild.
Yep. But highly recommend Abducted in Plain Sight, Netflix, if you're ready to yell at your screen.
Okay.
Because there's so much I left out, and there's so much, like, little things that I was like, ugh. It's just so gross.
Yeah. I just, like, I don't understand how a family can, like, be so trusting. Because I think I saw don't think I finished the entire series, but I did definitely see, like, the first episode or two of it, because it's a series, right?
No, it's just the one.
Oh.
But you might get, like, the first so frustrated. Half of it. You may get so frustrated that you just turn it off, because it, as, like, as soon as you find out the parents were also sleeping with him, it's, like, the most frustrating.
Yeah.
Like, in the world.
I just don't understand, like, ugh.
The man is
just gonna pour some more vodka in my drink.
When the FBI found his motorhome the second time, he had, like, giant printouts of Jan and, like, giant printout pictures of hers, like, some sort of fucking weirdo.
Boy.
Like, it's gross. Gross. Yeah. Gross. I didn't even get too much into his therapy because it's just so, ugh. Every turn, you're just like, why? Why is this happening? This could have been so easily avoided if the parents were just on top of their shit and not so easily manipulated.
Right.
Like, they even mentioned, like, one family, the Clark family, and they, like, glaze over it super quick. But the Clark family went out on vacation with him, and the father noticed that he was paying special attention to his girls and, like, shut that shit down. And now they're not victims of this chaos.
Right.
Yeah.
Cause he saw that and was like, nope. So that's there was some sanity in some people. These people were just so naive.
I like, it makes you wonder though, like, I feel like it goes past naivety, like, in this case, like.
Oh yeah. Cause if you're both fucking him and thinking you're in love with him.
Yeah.
At some point the parents are almost divorced. It's like, it gets a whole craziness.
That's fucked up, man.
Yep.
That's wild.
It's a good one.
Yep. Good choice.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Okay.
All right.
Who's up next?
That would be I.
Chelsea, what have you got for us?
So, when we recorded last and you said we're going to do missing persons, this is the first person that popped into my head because I remember following it on the news. And that is the disappearance of Natalie Holloway.
Yeah, I remember that one.
Never heard of
it. Really?
You've
No.
Oh.
That was huge news. Yeah.
Yeah. It like
it was in high school.
United States. Yeah. She just graduated, but they covered it like relentlessly in the United States for like years. And then yep. You're on. But yeah, it got to the point where the media was like interfering with like investigations and stuff. And it really just fucked everything up. The United States involvement, like media involvement, really fucked up the investigation.
Yeah.
Oh, shit.
The case.
Yeah. All right. So Natalie Holloway was the firstborn daughter of Dave and Beth Holloway on October 21st, 1986. She lived in Alabama and attended Mountain Brook High School, where she was an honor student, was on the dance squad, and regularly participated in other extracurricular activities. In 2005, she graduated and was set to attend the University of Alabama, where she received a full scholarship and was planning to be on a pre-med track once she started school. In May 2005, 124 students of Mountain Brook High School, including herself, went on an unofficial school graduation trip to Aruba. The school had 7 chaperones go with the group, where they had daily touch bases to ensure everyone was doing all right. Apparently, it was set up where like they weren't like really fully like chaperones. They're just more of like touch base people for like the parents' ease of mind.
Yeah, well, it's, I like, guess 7 of them touch for 150 kids.
Yeah. Yeah, but they're all 18. They, like, these are all graduates of high school at this point. Yeah. So,
okay.
Yeah, okay. I think it was more, it was like an unofficial school trip, and the chaperones were there mostly for the ease of mind for the parents.
Right.
The chaperones clearly did not do a really great job chaperoning, obviously, because they weren't really meant to, you know, be with them 24/7. Right. But during the trip, as the Holiday Inn they were staying at banned the school from returning due to excessive drinking, room switching, and wild partying.
Hmm.
Classmates stated that during the 5-day trip, Natalie participated in all of the events and stated that all of the drinking was excessive, which I'm going to just say that doesn't, you know, it doesn't really fucking matter that she was drinking a lot, because you go to Mexico and you drink, and all of us in our youth probably had some excessive drinking at this age, and we were just, you know,
bonkers.
Fortunate that no one abducted us. Yeah. I guess
I wasn't a real big drinker at that age, though. I mean, I'm not a big drinker now, so
I can say without a doubt that my drinking was excessive in my graduation to mid-20s years.
Same.
It was some rough stuff.
Yep. Like I said, I don't think I drank as much until wine night.
You're welcome. But see, wine nights for me is not excessive.
No.
Like, I'm like... No. Like, talk to me after you finish like 2 handles of Jaeger and playing a bunch of beer pong. Like,
remember amongst we had Everclear?
5 people.
Jungle juice.
It was like 2 handles of Jaeger, like Jungle 30 juice. Packs of beer.
Jungle juice was the thing when we were in college.
Irish beer, nasty. Irish car bomb pong.
Mm, I love Irish car bomb
for St. Patrick's Day. That was rough.
Oh no.
That swore me off of Irish car bombs for a long time.
They're so good though.
Not in that quantity.
No. We used to play, we got to the point where we played liquor pong.
Oh yeah, we did that. I hated I did not drink beer until I was in my late 20s. So anytime we played beer pong at any party, I was playing liquor pong.
Oh shit. Oh,
I could not.
Like, our middle cup was a double shot of Patron.
Mm,
and then we had like, we made like mixed drinks that went around like the back row, I think was like Hurricanes. And then we had like other like drinks all the way around.
I love that.
Like, we went all out.
I would do that
and it
now.
Was
damn.
Bad times. I do it now too.
I would recover for a week, but I would still
yeah.
Do it.
If you want to take like a weekend off, like, I'll come over and let's play some liquor pong.
A weekend. Need a week.
Yes.
I'm going to need a strong partner. Yeah.
It'll be fun. But yeah, but like having like a good time, like drinking with your friends. So you just graduated. You got a full ride scholarship to a university. Like, that shouldn't tarnish your reputation. And the media kind of concentrated on that, on her wild partying. And they forget that she was, like, an excellent student. Like, you don't get full rides just for, you know, skating by.
No,
she was celebrating and having a good time. And it's people shouldn't concentrate on that. However, though, on Monday, May 30th, around 1:30 a.m., Natalie left a nightclub with Joran Vandersloot, where she got into a car with him. Yeah, he's a Dutch. Because Aruba is a Dutch colony.
Oh.
Right? It's like...
Yeah.
I forget what it's called, but it's an island in, like...
It's kind of like the...
South America.
One of their territories. Kind
of
like
it's the a Dutch US territory. Virgin
Islands. Got it.
Yeah. So he was there going to school, but she got into a car with him and two of his friends. Natalie was scheduled to fly out the same day, but she did not show up for a flight. And when the chaperones investigated, they found her packed luggage and her passport still in her hotel room.
Oh, no.
Aruban authorities were quickly notified, where they initiated searches across the entire island. Natalie's mother and stepfather arrived the same day of the missed flight and began searching for their daughter. Within 4 hours of their own personal investigation, they were able to get the name and address of Joran Vandersloot from the night manager at the Holiday Inn, who recognized him.
Mm, they're good.
Yeah. They wasted no time.
Yeah. Good parents. See? Yes. Within hours, not 2 weeks, not 5 days.
They went to another country to find their daughter.
Right.
Same day.
Not 5 days.
They're also very well off. They took a private jet to Aruba.
Don't fucking care. I would take out my credit card.
Same day.
Not same day, people. Same day. We don't let the trail go cold.
So when Joran was originally confronted, he denied even knowing who Natalie was. He then changed his tune and stated that they drove to the California lighthouse where she wanted to see sharks. And then he dropped her off at her hotel room around 2 a.m. He stated that Natalie then approached a dark man in a black shirt similar to those worn by security. He states that this is the last he saw of her before he drove away. Under unfortunate circumstances, the camera system was not working at the hotel that night, so there's no way to know what happened for sure. But of course, the night manager did recognize Joran Vandersloot, so he was at the hotel at some point with Natalie. Yeah. On June 9th, Joran and his two friends were arrested on the suspicion of kidnapping and murder of Natalie. Unfortunately, the whole investigation was botched. There's a lot of interference by the United States media, and the police said that there was pressure from Natalie's family and the media to make arrests, which, I mean, come on, you're the police. You should know when you should make arrests and not just, like, cave at the will of people wanting justice. Like, you need the evidence.
Yeah.
So they lost valuable time actually researching, gathering evidence, and just started making these wild arrests everywhere. Misinformation was regularly passed around amongst the investigators to the point that spokespeople for the department were making public statements that were absolutely not true.
What?
And that includes that they had found Natalie's body or they knew where it was, and they never did. Mm-hmm. We still don't know where Natalie's body is.
Mm-hmm. Oh, shit.
So police were also just on an arresting spree at this point. After Joran's interrogation, they arrested a disc jockey from the nightclub. Joran's father was arrested and two security guards were arrested. All were released in a matter of days, and Joran also changed his story around this time that he dropped Natalie off at a nearby beach and not the hotel, but he maintained that he did not harm her. Joran's two friends were later released from prison on July 4th, and Joran was released 60 days later. The investigation continues for years with more arrests, but with always the same outcome of the suspects being released days later. In a complete jackass move, Joran released a book called The Case of Natalie Holloway in April of 2007, where he details his account of the night Natalie disappeared and the media frenzy that followed. In November of 2007, Yuron was arrested again on the suspicion of manslaughter and serious bodily harm that resulted in the death of Natalie. In December of 2007, Yuron was released again, and the case was closed due to lack of evidence.
Why'd they felt like he arrested, they could arrest him in the first place then?
I don't know. Like, because he was arrested in November of 2007 and released just like a couple weeks later.
Yeah.
And then they just closed the case because there was no evidence. So it seems like they were just making these wild arrests all the time.
I wonder what was in his book. Maybe it was something in his book.
What book?
The book.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Maybe. So.
Kind of a bitch move. Probably a money grab.
Oh, well, definitely yeah. Money grab.
Right? And it was only 2 years after the case, and like Natalie's family is still looking for answers, and they think Yuron is the key to these answers. So after he was released from his latest arrest, he couldn't leave it alone, and in March 2010, he attempted to extort Natalie's family. For $250,000, he said he would tell them the location of Natalie's body.
He's a douchebag.
Such a douchebag.
Now, what the of actual course. Hell?
And so the United States indicts him. So if he ever, like, gets to the point where he can be released to United States custody, he will face extortion charges. But something happened before that could even come to play. So on May 30th, 2010, exactly 5 years after Natalie's disappearance, Stephanie Flores Ramirez was reported missing in Lima, Peru. She was found dead 3 days later in a hotel room registered to none other than Yuron Vandersloot.
No!
Yeah. On June 3rd, Yuron was located in Chile and was promptly arrested for murder and extradited to Peru. Yuron pled guilty to killing Stephanie and said that he lost his temper after she got on his computer and found information linking him to Natalie.
No!
Yes.
How the tables have turned!
Yes. But Peru was a little smarter than Aruba on their handling of this case, and they just concentrated on the facts around Stephanie, and none of their interrogation really brought up Natalie at all, because they just wanted, they were trying to solve Stephanie's murder. So, unfortunately, we didn't get any new information about what happened to Natalie. But he was sentenced to 28 years in Peru prison.
Good on you, Peru.
Over the years, he has said some real fucked up shit. And if it's the truth or him just mercilessly trolling Natalie's grieving family, we will probably never know. But he has admitted to killing her. And after he recanted that statement, he admitted to selling her into sex slavery, which he later recanted as well.
Jeez.
And unfortunately, it is likely we'll never really know what happened to Natalie, but to gain some peace, an Alabama judge declared Natalie Holloway legally dead in absentia on January 12th of 2012. And that is the disappearance of Natalie Holloway. And that happened in 2005.
Yeah, I remember that.
And I was a junior in high school when that happened. And I remember watching it all the time and just being like, oh, like it's like it was one of those like shattering moments, like that the world
remember
like,
this
fucked
at
up.
All. I don't.
It was
remember
big.
This. Yeah, it was big news. I remember following that too in high school.
I didn't really watch the news. I think I only paid attention to the news in college, and then as soon as I stopped my journalism degree, I was like, buy news again. So, and my life is much better for it. The peace I have found. Without the news is much better for it.
Mm-hmm.
No regrets.
Yeah, I used to ignore the news a lot, and recently I've been paying more attention to it. And it's really just up my stress level in life. So
it does that.
Yeah. I recommend you don't. You're like the John Mulaney skit where he's like, I didn't pay attention because there wasn't a horse in the hospital. There's a horse loose in a hospital. Makes me laugh every time. I don't even know.
I love him. You guys watch Big Mouth?
No.
No.
You should. It's good.
Okay.
If you want to watch a cartoon that's... I feel like they do a really good job of growing up and experiencing like puberty and all the weird emotions that come with it.
Mm-hmm.
it's a very much an adult show, 100% an adult show, but it's about like kids going through puberty and it's a cartoon. So it's very inappropriate and has like John Mulaney is one of the voice in it, Nick Kroll's in it. And it's hilarious, but very inappropriate. And I think they do a great job. Depression Kitty was the most accurate thing I've ever seen in my life.
Noted.
Ugh,
okay.
I need a refill.
Yeah. Refill time.
Yes.
Woohoo. Commercial break. Yes. We will be right back with Jackie's missing person case.
Yes.
Okay. We ready, Jackie?
I'm ready. Are you guys ready?
I'm drunk, by the way.
Chelsea's drunk. Welcome back.
I've held it together.
Jackie has to tell us her kidnapping story.
Yeah. Mine's kind of insane. So it's got like.
I'm excited.
It's got missing kid. It's got international.
Is it Adam Walsh?
No. It's got international espionage.
Ooh, Madeline McCain?
No. It's not American.
Madeline McCain was French, wasn't it?
Yeah, it's not Europe either.
Oh, okay. Oh.
We are going to Japan in the late 70s. We're going to talk about the disappearance of Megumi Yokota, who disappeared in November of 1977. She was just 13 years old. She was the last time she was seen was coming home from badminton practice with her friends. And the last reported, last time someone reported seeing her were she was talking to her friends 800 feet from her house and she vanished. Vanished. Her parents contacted the authorities right away. Massive manhunt went underway. There is a pine forest that was nearby the family home. They searched there. Their family also lived by the shore, by the Sea of Japan. So they were searching the beach. They were searching the parked cars that were by the beach. And it turned up, their search turned up nothing. And they searched for a long time. I think the authorities clocked 3,000 hours towards the search for this girl. And nothing came up. She was completely just wiped off the face of the planet.
That's insane. Holy 800 crap. Feet from her house.
It's right near her house. And she's gone. She just snapped.
I could run 800 feet without getting super winded.
Yeah. So this was, yeah. So here's where things start to get interesting. Around the same time in Japan, multiple other reported vanishings happened. Megumi was the youngest at 13. A lot of the other people who disappeared were in their 20s. But same thing, they were last seen in a public place and then they just vanished without a trace. So rumors started up in the late 70s, early 80s, that some sort of international espionage was to blame. So essentially what Japan was saying is that some other foreign entity was coming in, snatching their people and taking them
probably
away.
Probably Russia.
It was Korea. North Korea.
Oh, whoa.
So North Korean spies at the time were coming over to Japan. They were snatching people in their 20s, bringing them back via boat across the sea of Japan to North Korea, where then they would serve as teachers and they would teach North Korean spies Japanese. They would teach them about the Japanese culture so that these spies could then go into Japan and work effectively undercover. So
sneaky.
Yeah. They would also take the identities of the people that they snatched and use them as as aliases for their spies coming back into the country. So that's why they were targeting people in their 20s. Megumi's abduction was essentially a fuck up. So what happened was the North Korean spies landed on the beach with their boat. Megumi saw them. They saw her see them and they were like, shit. So they snatched her, put her in the hull of the ship, and then she spent 40 hours in the pitch dark on the boat ride back across the ocean to North Korea. And it wasn't until they got her back over there and pulled her out that they realized that she was just a child. And then they were like,
oh, shit.
When they pulled her out, her fingernails were all bloody because she'd been trying to crawl her way out. She was crying for her mother. She refused to eat. So they were just trying to calm her down and say, look, like, if you behave and you can learn a language, like, we'll let you go home. Which was a fucking lie. They were never
yeah, why would you learn the language if you were going to go home?
They were never intending to let her go. Now, while this originally happens, her parents have no idea. They don't know what's going on yet. So this is just rumors, late 70s and the early 80s. It wasn't until there was a bombing. I'm trying to find the year. So it wasn't until 1980. So she disappears in 1977. 3 years later, in January of, or no, sorry, 1987, so 10 years later, there was a bombing of a South Korean passenger plane that killed 115 people. And the North Korean terrorist testified that she was a North Korean spy. She was acting under state orders. And she said that she was able to effectively work undercover because she learned the Japanese language from her teacher, who was an abducted Japanese woman whom she lived with for almost 2 years. So that's when rumors in Japan became validated. And then the Japanese government started demanding answers. They're like, we know you took our people. We want to know what happened to them. You need to let us know what's going on. So this back and forth goes on for another decade. And it's not until 1997 that the Japanese government kind of gets the information that they're looking for. And the North Korean government tells them, yes, they admitted to taking 17 Japanese citizens in the late 70s, early 80s. And they said only 5 of those 17 were still alive. And they listed a list of different deaths, ranging in from suicide to heart attacks to car accidents, which, I mean, North Korea at this time didn't really allow their citizens to own cars. So car accidents are kind of a bullshit way to die in the country. So of the 5 people who were listed as being alive, Megumi was not one of them. So North Korean government told Megumi's family that she committed suicide, that she hung herself in a pine forest behind a mental hospital where she had been admitted for being treated for depression.
What?
So her family's like, we don't believe you. And it takes another 2 years for the North Korean government to send back her remains, which they cremated her remains and they sent it back to Japan for her family for some closure. Well, part of Japanese custom is to hold on to the umbilical cords of their children when they're born. So when they got Megumi's remains, they had it DNA tested to her umbilical cord, and it was not a match.
Some smart-ass parents.
It was not a match.
Unlike some other 5-day people.
Megumi's family was not the only family to receive questionable remains of their loved ones. There was another case where a young man had gone missing who was in his early 20s when he went missing. And based off of the date of death that the North Korean government gave the family, he would have been in his early 40s when he passed away. When they got the remains back and had the remains checked, there were bone fragments from a jaw of a 60-year-old woman with the remains. So
what?
The North Korean government was essentially just protecting their assets. So no one knows if she's still alive.
They were just sending some people. They were just sending some random people.
They were essentially just sending remains back to this family as closure. Like, please stop digging. Your loved ones are dead. Their loved ones are still working as state agents, like helping their spies.
But like, who are they sending to these people?
Just random dead people.
Yep.
It's like your Mamiya mummies. Like, they're just like random people.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
So what's crazier is she is still not resurfaced, this girl.
Oh, Megumi.
But her granddaughter has. Or her daughter has. So her parents. Yeah, she had kids. And her daughter has met or has had contact with her mother. So Megumi's mother has met her granddaughter, but has essentially never seen her own child again.
Oh, wow.
And that is the disappearance of Megumi Yokota.
That's fucked up.
That is
some crazy shit. Insane.
Yeah. That is some crazy shit.
Insane.
I don't even know. That was a good one. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I've never even heard of that before.
Yeah, I've never heard of that one.
Yep.
Well, I haven't heard a lot of
There's a documentary on that, too. I don't know when it came out, but it won a bunch of awards when it's
interesting. That one sounds like a cool documentary. That right? Like
you can write a whole plot to a movie based off of that.
It should be a movie.
It's crazy.
It should be a movie.
800 feet from her house, she was snatched by North Korean spies on accident, and then they just kept her there. Like, you're going to teach our spies how to speak Japanese, and you're going to teach them about our culture. And if you do that, you get to go home. Mm-mm.
I'm so
That's
sad.
Insane. 13.
Oh, it's
too young.
That's, yeah. I mean,
even they said that. Oh, shit. You're a kid.
I mean, this girl, my girl, Jan, was 12, 13, thinking she's in love with this middle-aged man.
That needs to have a baby to save humanity from the aliens.
Yeah.
No, not even, yeah, well, I guess that's what procreate means, but. I guess she didn't really understand the intention of procreate because the sex was just like
definitely not
super part of it.
Mm.
Yeah.
Hey.
You should definitely look up what she's been in though.
Yeah, definitely. I'll look that up.
I definitely will look at that too.
I forget the show that they refer her as being known for. I don't think I watched it. That's probably why. I think this is a good place to end.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Excellent work. Who's picking our next episode?
That would be me.
What are we doing next time?
I would like us to all research our hometown horrors. So wherever you were born, find something fucked up that happened around that town or area. It could be a battle. It could be true crime. It could be whatever there is, paranormal, whatever. And then just tell me your local hometown business that happened.
And the tea? Our hometown tea?
Yeah, the tea. Give me the tea.
I already have a really good one.
Hometown tea. I'm ready. Yeah. I will have to do some research.
Government interference.
For sure.
Yeah.
Okay.
National property.
I'm excited. What's the hometown tea? So that's next time. Yes. We are Tipsy Depraved Podcast. Follow us on Instagram at Tipsy Depraved Podcast if you want to know our recipes for our drinks and some other fun tidbits. Same thing as Instagram, as we are on TikTok. And then our Twitter is Tipsy Depraved. Thanks for joining us, guys. Bye.
Bye. Thanks. Bye.